Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. In my broadcast, some of you have noticed that you hear very little about financial support, and that's deliberate. We really trust God here on that score and firmly believe that God pays for what He orders. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. But on this program, I don't say a lot about those resources, much as I don't say a lot about finances, and I guess that omission in terms of resources kind of defeats the purpose. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored. One of them co-authored with my daughter, The Finality of Jesus Christ. It's a very important book. And if anybody will let the Scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage, Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. And finally, one about the pastoral ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. We continue our exposition of the book of Acts. We've come to Acts chapter 18, where the Apostle Paul continues his second missionary journey. Now he's headed for Corinth. We read in chapter 18, after these things, Paul left Athens. He went to Corinth. In Corinth, he found a certain Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus in Asia Minor, now Turkey. He had recently come from Italy with his wife, Priscilla. He'd come from Italy because Claudius, who was the emperor from 41 through 54 AD, he had commanded upon an occasion all Jews to leave Rome. So Paul in Corinth came to them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they were working, for by trade they were tent makers, all three of them. And we're told he was reasoning in the synagogue. We've learned to expect that for reasons that I've explained again and again. Reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath. He was trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. These Greeks would be what we call God-fearers or Gentile proselytes who had left paganism and attracted to the high moral monotheism of the Jews, had been taught in the religion of the Old Testament. But when Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, they had been up in Berea, Paul began devoting himself completely to the Word and solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. Let me give you the physical setting of Corinth. Corinth was a very politically and commercially strategic city located 82 miles west-southwest of Athens. It was the capital of the Roman province of Achaia, which included Athens. Corinth was situated on a plateau in central Greece, overlooking the four-mile isthmus. It was more or less the Panama Canal of that era, though until 1873, sea craft had to be hauled overland. But it connected the Aegean and the Adriatic Seas. Its eastern port was Kenkrea, and Lechium was its western port. In terms of its moral climate, Corinth, as you may have heard, was the San Francisco of its era, though it had, as does San Francisco in ours, many rivals for the crown of debauchery. Though several hundred years previous, its population base, including slaves, had been greater than in the New Testament era, Corinth was still a city 10 times the population of Athens. It numbered at least, scholars have estimated, as many as 800,000 people in the time of Paul. Its population consisted of local Greeks, freedmen from Italy, Roman army veterans, businessmen and government officials, and Orientals from the East, including large numbers of Jews. That description comes from Longnecker. There are a couple of mute lessons in human history and culture here. By here, I mean in the case of Corinth. One is this. Time has a way of being unfriendly to all the monuments of human pride and achievement. We see that in Corinth. Eventually, all that man boasts in goes down the historical drink, leaving only remnants to testify about the fickleness of human wealth and the futility of human power to create anything that long endures. And you know what? Had it not been for the missionary ministry of the Apostle Paul, Corinth would now be a name familiar only to classical academics. Corinth would have been a name lost in the dim midst of antiquity. So why is this relevant, what I'm pointing out? Just this. Let's remember that in all of our sweaty efforts to make our mark, to leave a legacy and to throw up around ourselves walls of inviolable security, just remember that only what is done for Christ will last and only what enriches us for eternity matters. In this brief life, my friends, don't be a fool. Don't bet on the wrong horse and don't put your money in the wrong bank. Corinth stands as a mute monument of human folly. Of course, I'm not the only one, but I'm one of those who's had the privilege of being there and standing. And I'm telling you, it's mostly a bunch of rocks and just the relics of a few monuments. It came to nothing. There's another mute lesson in human history and culture that we'd be wise to take note of, and that is that perversity and immorality love a crowd and they multiply like mice in a multitude. The world over and through history, whenever you throw people together in great numbers, we saw it back then, we see it today, you accelerate the best in human enterprise and creativity. But here's what goes with it. We exacerbate the worst in human nature. Anytime you throw fallen human beings together in great numbers, you amplify the virtues and the vices of that constituency. Throw an overflow of wealth and luxury into the mix, and you will always see the multiplication of vice on a grand scale. You see that if you read the Roman historians, Suetonius and Tacitus. Goodness, that lesson is written in bold letters. Why is this relevant? Well, if you aspire, as let's say so many young people do, to live in the big cities where the action is, and there's nothing inherently wrong with that, but never underestimate the downsides and the undertow of urban life. Remember Lot? Though vice and corruption, especially in these days of ubiquitous communication means, are no strangers to either countryside or city, the dangers and the decadence of the megalopolis are exponentially greater in the big cities than in Mayberry, USA. On the other hand, if you're thinking in terms of mission, that is also where the need of the gospel is most obvious and where the greatest opportunity for breakthroughs are likely to happen. Let me talk about the spiritual need of Corinth. Corinth was a notable example of that matrix of conditions that I just talked about. Immorality, as I noted, was so rampant that in the ancient world, a word was actually coined to describe rank decadence. It was to Corinthianize. Can you believe that? That's the truth. They used that word in the ancient Greco-Roman world in a way similar to how people in our day speak fearfully of being Californicated, referring in the latter case to population overgrowth and out-of-control development. It was no compliment to talk about a place being Corinthianized. Though all big cities tend to be hotbeds of immorality and vice, Corinth, because it was a seaport city on two sides, and more especially because it was renowned as the center of worship of the pagan goddess of love, Aphrodite, Venus in Latin, accompanied by 1,000 sacred temple prostitutes devoted to providing sex as an act of religious devotion, Corinth was more notorious for its prolific sexual vice than others, including Rome, and that's a little hard to believe, but that's what the ancients say. The Temple of Aphrodite was built on the famous Acro-Corinth, an almost impregnable acropolis rising steeply, I've seen it, about 1,900 feet from the plateau floor, and you can see the remains of it to this day, as I mentioned. Let me talk here for a moment about God's timely provision for his servant, Paul. We don't know how long the apostles' layover in Athens lasted, we're not told. But we do remember that Paul was anxious for his partners in the work, Silas and Timothy, to join him ASAP. We saw that back in chapter 17, verse 15. It appears from 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, that one or both of them did join Paul, but out of extreme anxiety for the welfare of those new and persecuted believers, they were shortly dispatched again to Macedonia to check up on the new believers in Berea, also Thessalonica, or so it appears. And that left Paul all alone again in Athens, and now in Corinth. When Paul arrived in Corinth, he was there for a while before they reconnected again. What I want you to see is God's social and emotional provision for him. And I want you to see it because the same God cares for us in the same way. To take up the slack in social and emotional support, we see in verse 2 how God provided a Jewish couple who will become soulmates for the apostle in the absence of his team. Aquila and Priscilla had just recently immigrated to Corinth from Rome. They were part of a mass expulsion of the Jewish population from the capital by the decree of the Emperor Claudius sometime between January 25, 49 A.D. and 50 A.D. We know from secular sources, Suetonius' Life of Claudius, that what precipitated this was an edict of the Emperor Claudius that had its impetus in Jewish riots and unrest attributed to an otherwise unknown rabble-rouser by the name of Christus. Now, since Suetonius was not contemporary with these events and would not have understood the nuances of Jewish issues, many scholars believe, given the fact that we have no knowledge of any such Christus, the emperor expelled all the Jews instead of executing the precipitator, and seeing the close similarity of Christus, C-H-R-E-S-T-U-S, and Christus, C-H-I-R-S-T-U-S, many scholars believe the riots and the unrest in the Jewish community may in fact have been precipitated by controversy in the Jewish community over Christ. It's a reasonable and probable, though uncertain theory. Hating public disorder and contemptuous of Jews generally, and knowing nothing and caring less about the issues involving this Christus, Claudius apparently just decided to clear Rome of all its Jewish populations and restore peace and quiet by forcible expulsion. Aquila and Priscilla were among that exodus. They sailed across the Aegean Sea to the famous port city of Corinth, where in God's providence and God's provision they meet Paul. Not only were these folk already believers, we do not know the story of their conversion, but it just so happened that they shared with Paul the same trade. That's providential. That trade was tent making or leather working. The three of them settled down there in Corinth, They supported themselves by tent making until such time as Silas and Timothy would arrive. And here we see another example of God's holistic concern for his servants. In this case, the need for Paul is social and emotional provision, not just him, but also probably Priscilla and Aquila. Though God's spiritual objectives in our lives trump all other concerns, when eternal and strategic priorities allow, folks, God cares for and he will supply our temporal needs, and most especially as those needs affect our endurance and our ability to serve him. So let me emphasize that when social and environmental amendment is paramount in the equation of our spiritual health and service, friends, we can be sure God knows exactly what we need, when we need it, and how much we need it. Certainly he cared for his apostle, but he cares for us all. It's the same God. Jesus Christ yesterday, today, and forever. He never changes. He loves all of his people, and he will meet all of our needs. And this is just an example of a servant in need, or should I say servants, because they mutually supported one another. Now, on those occasions when there's no agreement between our own perception and God's provision, friends, we can rely on the fact that God is faithful, that there's always a good reason for his delays, his timing, and his measures, albeit hidden from us. And we may also be sure that there's an ability to endure. 1 Corinthians 10:13. God has put nothing on us but what is human, and he will always make provision for us in all of these situations so that it will never be necessary for us to sin or be unfaithful to God, but we'll always make a way of escape. But as we ponder those gaps, when the Lord is not, it seems, responding to our petitions about our needs, let me point out that it may be, one, that the Lord is testing our allegiance. Will we get in a twist and bail on him? Or the Lord may be stretching our endurance, that is, raising our threshold of patience as he works out his purposes. I remember when I was right out of seminary in my first church back in West Virginia, I occasionally would leave the office and walk up to the parsonage, which was only about a block away. And in our kitchen, we had a portable dishwasher. And as I would go in to talk to my wife, Aussie, and just catch up a little bit, the girls, we were quite small at that time, would come running around, as little kids will do, and grab me by the leg, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy." As I would talk to her, I would, usually it was the oldest, Christy, I would pick her up and put her up on top of the dishwasher, and she would jump off into my arms, and I would set her down, and she thought that was kind of exciting, and I'd put her up again, and she would jump off and set her down. And then I decided I would make the game interesting. God does this in a way. I would step back a pace or two and put her back up there, and she'd say, "Oh, Daddy." I'd say, "Oh, it's all right, honey. Daddy will catch you. Just go ahead and jump. Daddy, go ahead, honey. Come on. Come on out. Stretch out my arms." And all of a sudden, she'd work up the courage, and away she'd come. I'd catch her. She'd go down and go, "Whoo, that was fun." And I'd put her up, and she'd come off again and again. And then finally, I'd step back another pace or so. "Daddy, that's too far." "No, it's not." Well, you see, God does that, and that way he tests our endurance. He stretches us. Sometimes the Lord may be stimulating our seeking him by waiting, that is, drawing us to him in prayer and into his word for guidance and light and comfort, and forcing us into self-examination, which is always good for us. Fourthly, God could be sending us a message in those times when provision is not arriving in a timely way. There may be a message about our lack of obedience, or perhaps about just selective obedience. And there may be a lesson. Sometimes, this is where self-examination comes in, about our self-centered priorities, about preoccupation with our felt needs rather than our investment in his earthly purpose and mission. A message about our using him as our cosmic valet rather than to surrendering to him all out as our sovereign Lord. Again, as I've noted before, in verse 4, we see the apostle reasoning from the scriptures in the synagogue. He was attempting to persuade the Jews and the Gentile proselytes that the Old Testament prophets actually predicted the Messiah, the Christ, must come, suffer, and die, and that this Jesus of Nazareth was indeed the Christ, that is, the Messiah. Both of those issues his suffering and his dying, were real stumbling blocks to the Jews. Go back to chapter 17, verses 2 through 3 and see that. Those were particularly Jewish stumbling blocks, and so in speaking to Jews, the apostle contextualizes his message to their issues. By that I mean, he tailors his preaching angle to meet their aspirations, questions, and objections. So now, in verse 5, Silas and Timothy arrive from assessing the state of the Macedonian converts and the new churches that they had just recently established there. With them, as we know from 2 Corinthians 11:9 and Philippians 4:11, comes to Paul a gift of financial support for his team. That gift now frees the apostle up from the necessity of supporting himself by tent making. Another example of God's provision. God has a plan, he has a provision. God pays for what he orders, to use an old expression. Therefore, we see that he devotes himself completely, verse 5, to the ministry of the word. And the ministry of the word is summed up as solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. That was his arch motif. By the way, this is the origin of the phrase that we often hear in Christian circles today. When someone is said to be in a tent-making ministry, it means that that person is, usually, trying to plant a new church on home or foreign fields, but is supporting himself and his family temporarily by his own labors and skills until such time as the new work has grown sufficiently to pick up the full support and to free that servant from distraction. So for whatever it's worth, you now know the derivation of that phrase if you didn't already. Again, an application here. Throughout biblical times, the Old Testament priests and New Testament apostles and pastors or elders, God has planned that his people underwrite the living expenses of their shepherds. That's so that they can devote themselves, as Paul did here, without distraction to the service of the Lord. In the New Testament era, the whole idea is to free up from the marketplace those whom God has reserved for the ministry of the word, so that those shepherds can give themselves wholeheartedly to their spiritual duties. For if they must engage in secular employment to provide for themselves and their families, it's obvious they necessarily must neglect to that extent the Lord's calling and priorities. The church does not support the servants of God, the ministers of the gospel, so they can work less. The church supports them so that they may work more unfettered in the things that ultimately matter. In this connection, folks, always remember this. Your shepherd's needs, your pastor's needs out there are like your needs. So my counsel to you is to take care of them and their families. Take care of them like you would want to be taken care of if you and your family were in their position. That's so important. If you've got a faithful shepherd out there, then you be a faithful giver, and you give as unto the Lord. You put your money behind them because, as the scripture says, as Paul says, those that minister to you in spiritual things, it is only appropriate that you minister to them in material things, because they cannot do their work without distraction unless they are freed up from the demands of the marketplace. And a lot of people don't understand that. And if you have a pastor out there, don't forget not just to pay him an adequate salary, but remember, just as your family needs insurance, he needs insurance. Just as your family needs a car that won't break down 5 minutes out of the driveway, remember, they need a reliable vehicle. Think of those things. A lot of people do, and there are a lot of people who don't. God bless you if you do. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. You just have a wonderful day, and join us again next time.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.